You're listening to the Zandbergen Report, where wealth strategies and investment wisdom collide with Bart Zandbergen, your distinguished host and certified financial planner.
Welcome to the Zandbergen Report, a showcase for wealth strategies and investment wisdom that's essential for our evolving world. I'm your host, Bart Zandbergen. In studio today, as usual, is Paul, which I'm trying to keep far away from the desk because we have a beautiful bottle of red wine here that he seems to be drooling
over. Oh, my goodness. You know, you talk about wealth strategies. Today, it's lifestyle of the rich and famous strategies here as we talk about your expertise. Not only are you a connoisseur of all these other things, you are an actual sommelier.
Indeed. And with me today is another wine expert. And can't wait to get into this interview, one of my most favorite subjects beyond finances, which is wine. And as I introduce Josh Lavis, he has one of the best bios ever. Matter of fact, kind of want to be him. This is a great bio. A lover, not a fighter. Family and friends come first. Traveler and lover of fine wine, food, and history. Veteran of the wine industry, 14 years in sales, importation, distribution, and retail and fine wine. East Coaster who finds paradise in Southern California. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bart.
All right. So we have so many things we can talk about with wine. We're going to have to do many, many more. But let's start with how you got to be you. How'd you get in the wine business and what brought you here to your paradise in Southern California?
Well, 14 years ago, right out of college, I was actually working at a law firm. And I realized pretty quickly that that was not for me. I needed to be out with people. I needed to be outside of four walls. So actually, my parents had a wine shop. Okay. And, you know, having a conversation with my father, I said, you know, Dad, I don't know what I want to do. Can you give me some fatherly advice? And he said, you know what, Josh? Just follow your heart. Follow your passion. And, you know, growing up, actually, my dad used to let me have a little bit of wine. You know, we were Italian, so that was part of our culture. So I was introduced to wine at a pretty young age, and it was something I was always interested in. Never really had exposure to good wine until a little bit later in life. But it was something I was interested in, and an opportunity came to me, an old high school friend, actually. He said, Josh, there's this great opportunity to drive a wine truck. And I said, wow. I'm not sure if that was my dream job, but you know, I thought about it and I kept in contact with this guy. And, you know, about 6 months later, he said, you know, there's another job opportunity. It's a merchandiser position. And once again, you know, basically starting from the bottom. And I thought to myself, you know what, this is worth a shot. So I got the job. And in about 6 months, I worked my way up to a sales route, got recruited to go work for another fine wine company. And I've been in just about every part of the wine industry since. You mentioned in my bio, I've actually imported wines. I've worked for other family-owned wineries. I've sold wine. And all that was on the East Coast. And you asked me how I got out here.
Yeah.
It was a girl.
Always is.
So I followed a beautiful girl out here, and I thought, you know what? What better place to be in the wine industry than California? So that was about 2 years ago, and I'm never going to look back. It's just, yeah. It's amazing out here.
Yeah, it sure is. Well, you work for one of the best, if not the best, wineries in the Paso Robles area, Dow Vineyards. We'll talk about that. So I want to make sure we get there.
Sure.
But let's take the listeners through some of the basics. You have a CSW certified specialist in wine, which is a great certification. I know you're a level one sommelier, so all great certifications. Let's start with terroir.
Okay.
And not only is it a hard word to say, which I don't even think I said it right, but tell listeners what that is and how that affects wines.
Well, terroir is actually a French word. I believe it gets lost in translation a little bit into English, but it roughly means the physical environment, and that could be the climate, that could be the soil, the topography of a vineyard, and all of those things really play a part into the grapes and later on into the wine. So it's a really important thing. No one can really quantify it, but you know, you could have a wine, a Sauvignon Blanc from a vineyard in France. And it's going to taste completely different than a Sauvignon Blanc from a vineyard grown, let's say, here in California.
Exactly. All right. Oh yeah, I wanted to say something about your comment from your dad. And this a quote, and I think it was by Richard Branson. It says, "Do what you love, and you never have to work a day in your life."
Love
so
that.
I think you're living that life.
I would say so. Yeah.
Okay. Here's another basic. So let's describe what tannins are.
Tannin. You know, I was thinking about this this morning actually when I was having my cup of tea. Tannin is actually found in many things. If you've ever oversteeped a cup of tea and had this feeling in your mouth like all of the moisture was just sucked out, there's actually tannin found in tea leaves. So that feeling that you get actually comes from tannin. The same thing actually from walnuts. Walnut skins have a lot of tannin. But as relates to wine, tannin is technically something called a polyphenol, and tannin actually is found in the grape skins. So that is why, and I'm sure we'll cover this in a little bit later, but that is why red wines, because all the color comes from the skin, are much drier than, say, a white or a rosé.
Yeah. So that's actually, let's talk about that for a second. So white wine is made from red grapes. Or can be. Let me rephrase. Can be from red grapes.
Correct. Correct. I like to use the example of a Pinot Grigio, actually.
Okay.
Which is technically not a red grape, but it's really dark, dark pink.
Yeah.
But we've all had Pinot Grigio, and it is about as clear and white as can be.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So then, can you explain a little bit about how a reddish grape can produce a white wine that's clear like that?
Sure. So, you know, all of the pigment or the color actually comes from the skin of the grape. So when you pick the grapes and you bring them into the winery and you crush to release the juice, the juice is actually clear. So when you're taking those grapes and you're crushing them, you're literally removing the skins off of the juice immediately. So that's why there's no color extraction. So it's technically, let's just take a grape like Cabernet Sauvignon, which is what we specialize in at Dow. If you crushed Cabernet grapes and you immediately remove the skins, you'd actually have a clear juice as well.
Right.
But what you do is you leave that juice in contact with the skins to extract that color. So that's where the color comes from.
Okay. And then the tannins, of course, in the wine are what pair well with certain types of foods, which is why someone might choose, I would recommend, something like your Cabernet Sauvignon with a heavy meat dish, right? Because the tannins are going to help kind of cut through the fats and the flavor of the meat. Would you agree?
100%. You know, the classic pairing is Cabernet and a nice fatty steak, a ribeye or New York strip or something like that. And that tannin actually tannin is an acid. So that fattiness or that creaminess will really help kind of cut through the tannin.
Yeah. And I know everyone's different and their tastes are different. But for me, to drink a Cabernet Sauvignon, especially a big one, and when we use the word big, we're talking about big tannins and kind of that drying. I have a hard time drinking it without eating a meal. No, it's not the same for everybody. I would defer more to a Burgundy or a Pinot Noir. I can drink way too much of that without eating and not have a problem.
Touché. Yeah.
But, you know, again, everyone's a little bit different. Maybe one of the last kind of more basic questions. So sulfites, and people talk about that. Are they dangerous? And is that what causes headaches?
We could probably do a whole show on sulfites, to be honest with you. And I don't know how much time we have on this topic, but I'll try to touch on it quickly. So
we're good.
Sulfites, it's actually classified as sulfur dioxide. And sulfites in general are used as a preservative and an antioxidant. You find it in almost any food. So actually there's laws, the FDA regulates how much, you know, or how many sulfites, and they're measured by parts per million that you can find in wine. Believe it or not, white wine typically has more sulfites than red wine.
Oh.
And most people who say they get headaches from sulfites are actually incorrect. A very, very small percentage of people actually have sort of an allergy to sulfites where the body can't break them down. But to be honest, a glass of orange juice has more sulfites than a glass of red wine.
Huh.
And it's important. You know, it keeps the wine fresh. It keeps the wine from oxidizing, which you do not want. Otherwise, you have an expensive bottle of vinegar. So, you know, sulfites are really not dangerous. They're actually, well, they can be in really, really, really high levels.
Yeah.
But they actually provide a service to the wine. They keep it fresh and they keep it stable.
So what do you think then for those that get headaches from drinking wine or get headaches from drinking, specifically more people say they get it from red wine than white wine, is it the tannins then?
I hate to say it, but a lot of times it's alcohol. maybe they've had too much. But there's other things found in wine, like histamines, which people can be allergic to and can cause headaches. Some people are allergic to tannin, which red wines actually, we talked about, have more tannin than say other wines. But most of the time, it's actually not sulfites that's the culprit. Yeah.
Well, you just shot a big hole in my theory. I have a good friend that he claims he can drink all the red wine in the world in Italy and or any old world wine and not have a problem. And the minute he comes here and has a glass of new world red wine, he gets headaches. So I was throwing it on the sulfites, but
it could be. It's very possible that you know the EU maybe has a lower threshold for the amount of sulfites you can have in the wine, and you know a lot of it's probably local consumption. And to be honest, oftentimes the wines from Italy have a little bit lower alcohol levels than they do here.
So
US.
That's kind of typical with old world, new world, right? At least in my training, that the amount of heat. Which causes sugars, which causes higher alcohol, is going to be lower in the old world European wines than here in the U.S. or new world, Australia, U.S., New Zealand, right?
It can be. You know, there's certain parts, you know, Germany, Germany is very, very cold. And, you know, I was just actually having a beautiful Riesling the other evening, and it was about 8% alcohol. So, you know, there's certain regions that...
Yeah.
Produce wines of higher or lower alcohol. Yeah. I think it just depends on what your climate's like.
Right. We got to go to a break, but Riesling is, and we could spend a whole show just on Riesling, right? The different levels of dryness through sugar content and when to drink it. And I've always been taught that Riesling is probably the easiest pairable wine of all varietals.
Yeah, no, I'd love to come back and talk Riesling someday.
All right, time for a quick break. Be back in a sec.
Imagine what it would feel like to lose everything. Your job, your home, your family, your dignity. This has happened to thousands of the men, women, veterans, and young adults we serve at Working Wardrobes. What do we do to help? We provide career development services, life skills workshops, job skills training. We provide the perfect interview outfit, and we get clients placed in jobs. Call Working Wardrobes, 714-210-2460. Donate, volunteer, invest. Higher.
When it comes to pioneers in their respective industries, we all know the Apples, Starbucks, and Trader Joe's of the world. In the realm of recruiting, Decision Toolbox is the industry's best-kept secret. With 90% of their business from referrals and repeat customers, for over 20 years, Decision Toolbox's U.S.-based team of recruiters, sourcers, professional writers, quality personnel, and tech support has perfected a Six Sigma approach to talent management. No matter the size of the project, Decision Toolbox delivers incredible results. A cost per hire less than half of what contingency firms charge. With the winning candidate presented in an average of 14 days. All with a 12-month candidate warranty. With results like that, Decision Toolbox won't be a secret for long. Visit us at www.dtoolbox.com for more information.
All right, we're back on a fascinating subject here as Bart talks wine with some of his buddies here and some of his knowledgeable friends. I have to just clarify, because you're both so modest about this, and I was in the bar business for many years. I, in the restaurant business, I know how difficult it is to be a sommelier. Talk about, there's what, four levels of becoming certified as a sommelier? One of you, I think, is a one of you is a two, and then if you ultimately shoot to become a master sommelier, the highest level, there's only a couple hundred in the whole world that do this. Talk about that process a little bit and where you're both at in that journey here.
Yeah, sure. So for me, being a financial advisor, my becoming a sommelier was kind of a cross between having a passion and being obsessive compulsive. Because I took the passion and wanting to learn more about wine. There was my OCD. And then getting into it and realizing, well, I can't stop here. I can't quit here. And what's the ultimate goal? Sommelier. So... there was great education programs. The CSW, Certified Specialist in Wine, I thought was a great stepping stone. There's another program called the WSET or WSET, Wine Spirits Education Trust, run out of London. I took that program and went through the advanced course. And those really prepared me for the sommelier, which, again, as a non-industry person, never having worked in a bar or restaurant at all.
It's impressive.
Was pretty challenging.
And it isn't just a written exam that you can just bone up. I mean, they make you take, there's a blind tasting element.
So
to
yeah,
it.
8 o'clock in the morning, they started the blind tasting. So you have a red wine and a white wine. So that was for the level two. You asked about the different levels. So
right.
Level two, the master, which is a level four, is it 3 and 3, Josh? Or is it 6 and 6? Three reds, three whites?
It's three reds and three whites. Yeah.
So after that,
you got to nail it. You got to know, describe, you know, year and region and all sorts of characteristics just based on tasting it alone here.
Yeah, that's for another show as well, but it's called deductive tasting. So you start with sight, then you go to smell, then you go to taste. And from there, you have to start with a wide region, and then you, by process of elimination, work your way down till you get to the ultimate area and, you know, fingers crossed when you're doing a blind test.
Yeah, right.
You get it right.
And if you don't get it right, you come back again in 6 months or whatever and try it again here.
Yeah, which most people have to.
So you're a level two and you're just started the process? Is that what you're saying? Your guest just started the process?
Yes, I have level one. I'll be taking my level two this year.
Okay, all right. Impressive. I just wanted to clarify that because you guys aren't just talking, you know, a couple of guys that like drinking wine here. You've really studied this.
Well, we do that, but yeah.
And really, and I hope you will also talk, we have just so few minutes to do this, but I know you're going to talk about the investment opportunities and how did people get into wine? Because I think people, even wealthy people, are intimidated. I don't know enough about it to go buy it, to taste it, to try it. How long do I hold it? What do I pair it with? It can be a bit intimidating to people.
Yeah, it can, but I'm going to circle back and say something about that. So inevitably now, if we're out to dinner or at a party or whatever, people are intimidated if I'm drinking a wine, like you should choose or that's always a fallback. But at the end of the day, I always say, and I think this is true, you drink what you like, right? What totally. I like, even with my training, doesn't mean that you're going to like it. It's going to be different taste. I mean, the fact that I like Burgundy or Pinot Noir, a lot of people don't care for that, and they want the bigger wine, the Cabernet Sauvignon, so everyone has different tastes. But yeah, those are great, great things. We're going to get into that, and so we're going to talk about drinking, investing, storing, and so forth. So I don't know about you, Josh, but this blew me away, and I've done this now three different times at three different seminars, but drinking wine out of varietal-specific glasses, and Riedel does a great job at that, both in the education and, of course, in the designing of the glasses.
They do.
And I don't know about you, but I never would have thought blind tasted. One is in a plastic cup, right? So that's kind of a gimme. And mm-hmm. I'd rather drink straight out of the bottle than out of a plastic cup anymore. I don't drink straight out of a bottle. but it's just bizarre to me that the shape of the glass, the shape of the goblet, how a Riesling, a Sauvignon Blanc, a Cabernet Sauvignon will absolutely taste different in a different shaped glass. Have you experienced the same thing? Have you been through a training?
I've not been through one of those Riedel seminars, but you know, I do believe in the power of the right stem or the right glass. I totally think it can make a difference. You know, I've become a bit of a glass snob myself. You know, I have a bunch of Riedels at home. There's a couple other manufacturers out there, but I in my experience, that I think they produce the best. But yeah, I think, you know, especially when you have a passion for wine and you do invest, in a nicer bottle of wine, you know, you want to, you know, bring out everything that it has. And sometimes that glass can really help enhance the experience.
And I'm glad you said stem, because there is a somewhat of a movement, for the stemless. Riedel has the stemless, and you know why they invented the stemless glass?
I do not.
So the second or third generation Riedel lives in New York, or lived in New York, had very limited space, lived in a small apartment with a small cabinet. Hey, my glass doesn't fit in the cabinet. So he had them make the glass without the stem, and then it became a thing. I don't like what the holding the glass does to the temperature of the wine. So I'll take a stemless over a plastic glass, but I'll not use a stem.
Agreed.
And no judgment from anyone here in the room or in the audience, but even when we travel, Like if we do our summer vacation, we go to a place, and I've been there once, and they had really bad wine glasses. So I have a retail wine glass carrier that I pack and I take on.
Good for you, Bart. On board with me. I love that. Now I'm going to steal that idea.
You can borrow my case.
I like it.
Okay. Let's talk about storing wine. So, yeah, let's start storing. Then we're going to talk about purchasing and investments.
Sure.
How important? Tell listeners how important it is, and kind of roughly the temperature zones for the different colors of wine.
I think storage is really important. You know, especially once again we're getting into the investment type wines or wines that you plan on keeping for a while. The rule of thumb is you always want to lay the bottle down on its side. I'm sure a lot of people have heard that. And the primary reason for that is the actual cork. You want to keep your cork somewhat moist. So when you lay it down, the wine can actually touch that cork so it doesn't dry out. Because once it dries out, it shrinks. And two things could happen. It shrinks enough where oxygen can actually get into the bottle and oxidize the wine. And that's a big no-no. But also when you're going to open the cork, when it's dry like that, it'll completely disintegrate and you could wind up getting cork bits all in the wine.
Yeah, it's a mess. Yeah, it's a hot mess.
So, in terms of temperature, you know, there's, you know, a lot of research out there, you know, where you want to store the wine. I would say that I would definitely try and store it, no higher than around 64 degrees Fahrenheit. Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't have a, you know, like a Euro cob or some sort of wine refrigerator.
Yeah. Okay. I tend to store my whites colder and drink them colder against popular, not against popular, most, that isn't more popular, against the more rigid rules, but I prefer it that way. So let's try to do maybe just a invest in wine 101. What are some basics that you could offer?
Sure. You know, and it's a very interesting topic. That could be a whole other show, to be honest with you. But if you're looking to invest in wine, you know, I guess the first place to look would be probably Bordeaux. It's almost really become almost more of a commodity than an actual agricultural product like a wine. And you actually would buy a lot of the classified growth Bordeaux's on futures. So you would actually purchase them, or you could purchase them without even tasting them. You would basically just go on some sort of a barrel report. You know, somebody, some expert went and tasted wines out of the barrel and says it's going to taste like this in 2 years. Yeah. So they set the price at a certain level. And it's interesting because you could actually make an investment immediately if it turns out that the wine is even better than they expected. So then the price would actually go up. But the reverse could happen too, where you could pay a high price. Yeah. And it turns out that it's not a great vintage and you actually wind up losing money. But at the end of the day, the great thing is you can still drink it.
Right. It makes it have the right value. Top of your head, this is probably not a fair question. Can you think of the last 10, 15 years, like the best years for Bordeaux or even Cab, maybe California Cab?
You know, Bordeaux, you know, I want to say 2010 or 2009 was a good year. I mean, obviously 1982, which was my birth year, was an incredible year. I'm not as familiar with the great vintages in Bordeaux, but in California, just in Napa Valley, 2013 was incredible. In Paso, we've had a run of 3 or 4 incredible vintages. But, you know, in California, we're pretty lucky out here. You know, almost every year is a great vintage. But, you know, there's tons of reports out there. You know, Robert Parker, Wine Spectator, they do vintage reports for every single region. So if you're looking to, you know, invest in some wines, I mean, I would just start there. You could look at, you know, the internet's great for stuff like that.
Okay. So we're pretty fortunate being here in Southern California. We've got wine regions within driving distance, the great ones as well. Santa Ynez, I think, is great. And, you know, you could literally drive to Napa or Sonoma from here. But I'll tell you, one of my favorite spots anymore is Paso Robles. I think it's more, has a little more charm than what Sonoma and Napa do have now. I'm not cutting them down in any ways. It's just, it's maybe Napa and Sonoma 20 years ago, maybe longer. You're based out of there. Tell me a little bit more about the region and then, of course, more about your winery. Beyond the fact that it's the most, literally the most beautiful winery in the region with the highest point and the most spectacular view.
It really is. I've worked for George and Daniel Dow for about 2 years now, and you know, like I mentioned earlier, I've been in the business for 14 years, and I've never seen anything like it. You know, from the people, the passion, the place. I mean, you mentioned it really is a stunning property, and we're very, very fortunate to have what we have. The region actually has a long history. It dates back to the 70s. You know, and I would say the Paso is really starting to pick up a lot of national recognition just in the last couple of years. It really is kind of the local wine region. It's only about a 4-hour drive from here.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful drive at that. So, Paso Robles has got a great future too. You know, we really think the best is still yet to come.
Mm-hmm. And the varietals have changed, right? In the early days, if I recall correctly, it was a lot of Zin.
Correct.
And you've expanded a lot from there, right?
Actually, a lot of people don't realize that the most widely planted grape variety in the Paso Robles region now is Cabernet Sauvignon.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, and it did. Most people, when they thought of Paso, they thought of Zinfandel or the Rhone, you know, the Rhone varieties, yeah. Syrah, Grenache, yeah. Nuvet. It's Bordeaux varietals, in particular Cabernet Sauvignon. So yeah. that's our specialty now.
Yeah, great. And great wine. All right, Josh, we're running out of time here. I want to tell you it's been a great pleasure having you in the studio today. I have the pleasure of asking you the final thought question, which I do all my guests. So tell me what your ultimate lesson learned has been, either, I'm going to expand it, either over your career as a wine person, wine expert, and or you have a lot of wisdom, just over your life.
Wow, my life has changed a lot over the last couple of years. It's been an incredible ride. I love this thing we call the wine industry. You know, actually, this is not something that I came up with on my own, but someone who has been very, very successful in this wine industry told me, and it relates to everything, not just wine business, but no matter what success you have, always stay humble and kind, but outwork everybody else.
Very wise words. Thanks for sharing. That's a great one. All right. Super unfair question. What's your favorite varietal?
My favorite varietal. So George and Daniel will probably kill me for saying this.
Sorry
to ask. But I've always loved a grape called Nebbiolo, which is from the Piemonte region of Italy.
Italy, yeah.
And that's
heavy tannins, have big wine, right?
Heavy tannin, but actually very, very elegant and light. It actually has the same body as a Pinot Noir, but it has the tannins of a Cabernet.
Huh.
It's a very intriguing, mysterious wine.
Yeah.
And when done right, it can be incredible. So.
All right. Good to know.
Yeah.
All right, Josh. Thanks again for joining us in studio today. And for those who want to know more about Josh or learn more about the winery, you can visit him at Dow Wines at www.dowvineyards.com. That's DAOUvineyards.com. Thanks so much, everyone who has tuned in, and we look forward to having you back in the studio next week. Cheers.
Cheers.
Tune in next week for the latest edition of the Zandbergen Report, Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Catch up on our recent shows by visiting www.bartzandbergen.com. Interested in being a featured guest on our show or have a question you'd like to hear us answer on the Zandbergen Report? Email podcast@bartzandbergen.com.